Okay, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to week six. For those that are on Zoom, those are watching, I'm not, or on Facebook, I'm not wearing a mask, because when you speak, you don't have to wear a mask. But I am wearing it the rest of the time, so here it is. Okay. So before we start, just a housekeeping announcement. Today is the last one of the series. We're taking a break for the next 2 weeks, and the over school holidays, and then the next series starts on the 15th of July, Thursday the 15th of July. I'm working on a topic. I will let you know. And also today, please go out towards the end of the shiur. We're going to draw the raffle as we always do. It's always the last Thursday morning of term two. And thank God we've done well. Thanks to all of you and all of your effort. So it's really appreciated. Okay, so we're doing lessons from Jewish history. So today I want to focus on a period of Jewish history that is a sad one, but it's a really important one because there's so many lessons and a very important lesson which we're going to go through that we really need to learn from this period of history. Why am I doing it today? Because it's this coming Sunday is what we call the 17th of Tammuz. It's a fast day, a mini fast day. And it begins a period of 3 weeks, 3 weeks of mourning, where we have 3 weeks leading up to the saddest day of the year called Tisha B'Av, which is 3 weeks from Sunday, the ninth day of Av, which is the day that both temples, both Batei Mikdash, were destroyed. Now, we've given a bit of context on that period of history when we spoke about Rabbi Akiva, but I want to just give a bit of background to this whole thing. So what we're going to see, and particularly with regard to Tisha B'Av, but also with the 17th of Tammuz, this coming Sunday, that sometimes when sad things happen in history, on a day, we find that the day has, it's not just that it happened in that period of time, but the day itself has some potential for things to happen, because we find that multiple things happened on these days. So the 17th of Tammuz, which is this coming Sunday, the first thing that actually happened is way back in Jewish history, when the Jews came out of Egypt and they were at Mount Sinai, and then 40 days later they served the golden calf when Moses was on the mountain. And then when Moses came back from the mountain, he came back down, he saw the Jews serving the golden calf. He had with him the first set of tablets, the Ten Commandments, which were engraved by God on stone. And Moses saw that, he dropped the tablets and he smashed the tablets, which is why we had to have a second set of tablets come to us on Yom Kippur, right? That happened on the 17th of Tammuz. There were other things that happened about sacrifices and an idol was placed in the temple and so on and so forth. But the reason that we fast is because in the second temple, the Romans, after laying siege on Jerusalem, in preparation for destroying the temple, it was the 17th of Tammuz, the Sunday where they broke the walls of Jerusalem. They entered into Jerusalem. There was a great struggle, a big war. And 3 weeks later, they approached the temple and set it alight and destroyed the temple, the second temple, that is. Right? But both temples were destroyed on Tisha B'Av. So that's the 7th of Tammuz. But later on, you have the day of Tisha B'Av. Now, Tisha B'Av, as I said, is the saddest day in the Jewish calendar. Also a day that so many things happened. The Talmud tells us about 5 things that happened, but then post-Talmud, more things happened on Tisha B'Av, which were tragic. And I'm going to run through them with you just to give you historical context. So, again, the first thing that happened, and this is actually going to be significant, so I'm going to say it clearly and with some detail, on Tisha B'Av was, again, when the Jews were in the desert. What happened was, a year and a bit after they came out of Egypt, they were then ready to go into the land of Israel, right? And they sent spies to the land of Israel to spy out the land and to prepare the Jews for entering the land of Israel and conquering the land of Israel and so on. We know the sad story that the spies came back. And when they came back, they gave a very negative report. Talked about how overwhelming it was to conquer the land of Israel, talked about how it's not going to be possible to conquer the land of Israel, and they created panic. right? Media creating panic is not a new phenomenon. It was all the way back then already. They created a lot of panic, but it was bad, negative results. And it says that Vayifku, they came back. They came back from the land of Israel on the 8th day of Av. That night was Tisha B'Av, right? And it says that night the Jews cried. They cried, they wailed, because they didn't want to go into Israel. And they were upset and they were overwhelmed and they didn't believe they could do it. And the way it's written in the Talmud is that God said that because you cried on this night, this day will become, and you cried for nothing. He says, "B'chiya shel chinam," it was a cry of nothing. In future, this day will be a day where we cry for something, right? So that became the day of national tragedy, became a day where so many things happened. Now, so that's the first story that happened to Shabbat. Hold it in your head because I'm going to come back to it later and share with you a fascinating insight. So this, by the way, this happened when the Jews were in the desert, and this is the year 1313 before the Common Era, BC. Later on, both temples that stood in Jerusalem, they have to understand the significance of a temple. When they went into the land of Israel, that was the destination when they came out of Egypt. They were supposed to land up in the land of Israel. But the land of Israel was incomplete without a temple. The whole idea was there was going to be this headquarters where God would live, so to speak, where there would be the revelation of the divine presence. And that would be the headquarters of Jewish spirituality and Jewish service and Jewish ritual, where Jews would come from all over and serve God there and praise God and connect to God and so on and so forth. So the temple was a very, very big deal. It was built by King David. It wasn't built by King David. It was built by King Solomon, the son of David. King David was the one to finish off the conquering the land of Israel and conquer Jerusalem and so on. This was some 300-400 years after the Jews already came into Israel. And they never had a temple yet because Jerusalem hadn't been conquered. And finally they built a temple and it was a very big deal. The temple stood for 410 years and it was destroyed by the Babylonians in the year 423, again, before the Common Era. Right? 5 centuries later, the second temple was destroyed because what happened was the first temple was destroyed. It was destroyed. They went into exile for like 70 years. They came back. I'll give you a bit of context later. And then the second temple was destroyed again in the year 69 of the Common Era. Later on, in year 133, because after the destruction of temple by the Romans, we know that Beitar was still a stronghold, and the Jews still hung on to Beitar. There was a revolt against the Romans led by Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba was so great that the Jews actually thought, I think I mentioned this when I spoke about Rabbi Akiva, this was later after the temple, Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba would actually be Mashiach and he would usher in a messianic era, and it wasn't to be. And in fact, on Tisha B'Av in the year 133, Beitar was brutally conquered and destroyed by the Romans. It was a terrible tragedy. A year later, the Romans came to Jerusalem and they wanted to eradicate all remnants of the temple, so they plowed the Temple Mount. What do you know today as Temple Mount is where the temple stood. They actually took a plowshare and they plowed the whole thing to look like a field, a regular field. So those are the things that happened that we know of from the Talmud that happened at Tisha B'Av. But what happened later is interesting, much, much later. In the year 1290, there was the expulsion of the Jews from England, right? England weren't always big tzaddikim, right? So we were expelled from England. And they were given a few months to put their stuff together, and there was a deadline, and by the deadline they had to move. They had to get out of there. That deadline was the 9th of Av. So the final expulsion of the Jews from England in 1290 took place on Tisha B'Av as well. 2 centuries later, 1492, was the deadline for the Spanish expulsion. So the Spanish Inquisition, who gave Jews a choice, either to leave or to convert, and if they stayed there and practiced as Jews, they would be burnt by the stake. So that happened on the deadline was Tisha B'Av, and in fact, in Tisha B'Av, it was a huge procession of Jews that left Spain. Some remained, as we know, they went into hiding, but there was a huge procession. In fact, there was a great Torah sage at the time, his name was the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel was actually a very, very prominent scholar, a wealthy scholar, a prominent scholar, a great man, and he was actually close to the government. And in fact, when the whole craziness came in with the Christian coercion of converting with the queen over there and the whole thing, he was actually given permission to stay. And he said to the queen, "That's not happening. If my brethren are leaving, I'm leaving. and hundreds and thousands of Jews left Spain on Tisha B'Av that year, 1492. And in fact, what he did was, we know that Tisha B'Av is a day of mourning, we're not allowed to play music, of course, you're not allowed to celebrate. He actually ruled that that year was different. They should leave Spain with a huge parade, they should play music, and they shouldn't leave as Nebachs, they should leave as proud Jews who have left because they're hanging on to the religion, and that's what they did, and they left. But that happened, that was a great tragedy, and that happened on Tisha B'Av. And finally, we know that, of course, the you know, the tragedy of our times was the Second World War, but the Second World War, many historians link with the First World War, and just say there was like a remnant, it was just a long drawn-out conclusion of World War I, right? And World War I, which began in 1914, when Germany declared war on Russia, that actually happened also on Tisha B'Av. So it's actually quite phenomenal that all these things happen on Tisha B'Av. So it's a day of national tragedy, national mourning. But mainly, it's a day that we mourn the destruction of both temples. Now, what I want to do is I want to actually just focus today on, I've told you things all over history that happened on Tisha B'Av, but what I want to focus on is the period of the Second Temple and focus on the destruction of the Second Temple and the lessons that we have to learn from that. Again, so the mourning for the Second Temple really starts, it's over a 3-week period, because we start this Sunday, which is called the 17th of Tammuz, where the breach of the walls happened, and that's when the war began. And over that 3-week period, we fast on Sunday, but then we have just a 3-week period of mourning, because we don't get married, we don't have haircuts, we don't listen to music, and that kind of stuff, over these 3 weeks. And then it ends with Tisha B'Av, which is the Sunday, 3 weeks from the Sunday. So the Second Temple was built. Second Temple was a very interesting period in Jewish history, just to give you a bit of context. It was after 70 years of the Babylonian exile, but the Jews were exiled to Babylon, which later became the Persian Empire and so on. And when they left Babylon, they didn't actually all leave. Interestingly enough, many, although they were given permission to build the temple, which should have been an amazing welcome celebration and a return to Zion, return to Israel, the Jews were actually a bit criticized that they actually didn't all return to Israel. They were given permission to return, they were given permission to build a temple, but actually a large community remained in Babylon. But the great sage Ezra and Nehemiah, those two sages, went back and they led the reconstruction of the Second Temple. But they were still not completely sovereign. In other words, Israel was still under Persian rule at that time. And the Second Temple was built on the year 349, right? Now, just as a side interest, a side issue, that when you go to Israel today and you go to the Kotel, the Western Wall, so theoretically that's a remnant of the Second Temple. Well, it's not really, I mean it is, but that wasn't really, that wall is part of the Second Temple, sorry, but it actually wasn't built in 349, because later on Herod, who lived much later, he actually re-renovated the whole temple. In fact, that Western Wall is his wall. It's a retainer wall that he built for the Temple Mount. So it is considered a remnant of the same temple, but it was actually built later. So the temple was built on 349 and stood for 420 years. But during the Second Temple, it was a very tumultuous time. It was a very rocky time, because the Jews had little, they had a bit, but they had about 100 years, but not more than that. They had very little self-sovereignty during that time. They were practicing in the temple. From that point of view, it was a great time. They had a temple. There was the miracles that happened in the temple and so on and so forth. Great high priests, great tzaddikim, great sages, and so on. But it was a rocky time, because for much of the time, they were under other nations' rule. It started off under Persian rule. Persia then got conquered, and then it became under Greek rule, which is, of course, when the Hanukkah story happened. It happened during the time of the Second Temple. The Hanukkah story ended with the Maccabim, with the Hashmonaim taking over and winning the war. That was the miracle of Hanukkah. And then they took over and they became, their sovereignty returned to Israel. They were independent and self-sovereignty. That happened for about 100 years until their family died out and the Romans became very strong and the Roman Empire began and they took over Israel, right? So towards the end of the Second Temple, they were under Roman Empire. King Herod was a remnant of the Maccabim house, the Hashmonaim. He wasn't actually a Kohen himself. He was a slave. He actually came from slaves of the house of the Hashmonaim. He was a master builder. And he renovated the Second Temple. But when he was king, he was under Roman rule. And then finally, besides and being under foreign rule, also a lot of the time during the Second Temple, there was a lot of infighting between the Jewish people, unfortunately. Some corruption happened. There was the movement of the Sadducees, the people who only believed in the written Torah, didn't believe in the oral Torah, and they created problems for, they sided with the, they collaborated with the Romans, and they were causing great problems for the sages of the time and the Sanhedrin. Towards the end of the Second Temple, there was different factions. There was the young zealots who believed we've got to fight at all costs, even though the sages really understood that it's all over. They understood with their divine insight that the temple was going to be destroyed. So it was a very unsettling time. And then eventually, in the year 69, the Romans actually came, and they were, I'm obviously just making a big summary of this, but this is what happened. Now, why was the temple destroyed ultimately? What was the reason the temple was destroyed? So this is the story that I want to focus on a little bit and draw the lessons. Just before was just a bit of historical context. So towards the end of the Second Temple, as I said, they were under Roman sovereignty. Now, the Talmud says, it says in two different places, but one place it tells us the famous idea that the reason why God allowed the Second Temple to be destroyed and the reason that the Jews were exiled yet again was for sinat chinam, baseless hatred. Right? Where do we see a story of baseless hatred? So there's another Talmud, a very famous Talmud, a passage which is often studied on Tisha B'Av, that says that because of a story relating to a person called Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. That's what it says. Now, many of you might be familiar with the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa, but just in case you aren't, I'm going to go through the story and then analyze it a bit and learn tremendous lessons from it. So the Talmud tells the following story, that before the destruction of the temple, this is what happened. There was a certain person, doesn't say his name, but he had a very, very close friend called Kamsa. Now, the name is significant, as we'll see later on. So hold that thought in your head. So he had a friend, a very, very close friend called Kamsa. The problem is he also had a very big enemy, someone he could not stand and tolerate, called Bar Kamsa, which normally in ancient Aramaic would mean the son of Kamsa, but that was his name, Bar Kamsa. This fellow, again, doesn't say his name, anonymous, he threw a banquet one day, threw a party, to which he invited some prominent people, including some of the rabbis and the sages, and he asked his attendant, he asked his servant to please go and deliver an invitation to go and invite Kamsa, his friend. The attendant was a bit confused and he mixed it up, and instead of inviting Kamsa, he invited Bar Kamsa. Right? So Bar Kamsa was very happy. He thought that, you know, maybe the guy doesn't hate him so much anymore. Obviously this guy was a big macher, and everyone wanted to be invited to his party, I suppose. So Bar Kamsa arrives and the host walks in and he sees Bar Kamsa there and he sees red. And he says, "What are you doing here? You're my enemy, get out." And of course, by this time, this is a bit of an awkward position. Bar Kamsa is going to be embarrassed. He says, "Do me a favor, please don't embarrass me this way. Let me stay, and I will pay you for what I eat. I'll pay my way. And the host says, "Absolutely not." So he says, "You know what? Let me pay for half the whole party." He says, "No." He says, "You know what? I'll pay you for the entire banquet. Whatever the catering costs are, I'll pay for it, on me." And he says, "No, absolutely not. You need to go. And he threw him out. Bar Kamsa said to himself, there were people sitting there. He said there were rabbis sitting there. No one stopped him. No one said anything. The Talmud says from the fact that they kept silent, it must mean that they approved. And therefore, I'm going to fix them. So what did he do? He went to the government. He went to the emperor, the Roman emperor. He says he traveled to the emperor. Because at that point, the Jews were under Roman rule, but not under Roman oppression yet. They had religious freedom. They were allowed to serve, they're allowed to have a Beit HaMikdash, a temple, they're allowed to practice as Jews. So he went to the emperor and he says, "The Jews are rebelling against you." Wow. Right? Now I'm going to tell you the whole story because it's important. I want to learn lessons from the whole story. So the emperor says, "Well, how do you know that?" So he says, "You know what? Test it." This is what Bar Kamsa says to them, "Test it. I'll tell you what to do." The law was in the temple that, you know, a temple was a place that used to bring sacrifices to God. But the law was that not only Jews were allowed to be sacrifices, there was a concept of non-Jewish sacrifices as well. If a non-Jew wanted to bring a sacrifice, they could also bring a sacrifice. So he says, "You know what? Send back with me an animal, a fine calf," he said. "Send back a fine calf, and I'll tell them that it's from you, and they should bring it up as a sacrifice from the Roman emperor." So he says, "Okay, you'll see they won't do it. You'll see that they were rebelling against you." So he gives him a calf. Now, everyone was aware of the halakha, of the law, that for a calf to be brought as a sacrifice, it actually has to be without a blemish, has to be complete, right? So on the way, what Bar Kamsa did He took a knife, and behind the earlobe, he made a scratch on the animal's earlobe, or just behind the ear. He blemished the animal, but he blemished in such a way that it was a minor blemish, where to the emperor, it would be not considered a blemish at all. But for the Jews in the temple, it would be considered a blemish because the Jewish law about blemishes on an animal are very, very strict. An animal does not have even a tiny blemish to be brought on the altar as a sacrifice. That was the law. So he comes with the calf to the Sanhedrin. He says, I brought a korban, a sacrifice from the emperor. Could you please offer it up on behalf of the emperor? They take the animal, they inspect it, they see there's a blemish. And they actually realize what happened. They realize this is probably made by him and he's setting us up. So the Sanhedrin was brought before the Sanhedrin at the time, and one of the leaders of the Sanhedrin was a person called Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulas, a great sage. And he said, look, we can't. So one approach was, let's just offer it, because we're in danger here, right? Because they knew we're gonna upset the emperor. So he said, no, I don't think you can do that, because then people will say that you're allowed to bring a blemish with a sacrifice, a sacrifice with a blemish. And the context is that in the Torah, that's considered a very, very serious transgression. So others said, well, if that's the case, we don't have a choice. Since Bar Kamtza is putting us in danger, we should execute him. Because he's obviously making trouble. He's going to bring the whole Jewish nation under threat. We should hold him. We should execute him. We should take care of him. So Rabbi Zechariah, again, Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulas said, he said, no, that's not a capital punishment. It's not a capital transgression. Making a blemish on a sacrifice is not a capital sin. There's no way you can do that. So what happened was, excuse me, that's not COVID, don't worry. Thank you. What happened was, the emperor got the message that his sacrifice was not brought, and he accepted the information that the Jews were rebelling against him, and he sent the whole story. He sent Nero, a general, and then he sent another general. Bottom line is, he sent Vespasian. He laid siege against the whole Jerusalem. Vespasian was then recalled to Rome to become the emperor because the emperor died, and Vespasian's son Titus was the one to actually, with his army, to destroy the temple and to conquer Jerusalem and to exile the Jews. That's what it says, that because of baseless hatred, and this is an example of it, Sinat Chinam, that's how it came about, that the temple was actually destroyed. So, on this story, there are a few questions. Right? First of all, what does Sinat Chinam actually mean? What does baseless hatred actually mean? No one hates someone baselessly, one would imagine. In other words, if I saw two people have a real argument with each other, a real conflict with each other, they hate each other. They don't talk to each other, right? If you ask any of them why they don't talk, they will have a reason, definitely, right? So, oh, do you know what this guy did to me? I'll tell you. You have time? How long do you have? I'll tell you the whole story, right? Obviously, they're going to have a reason, yeah? So what does that mean, sinat chinam? No one will tell you that they have baseless hatred. There's always a reason. The guy offended me, right? You can say that, but hatred is not a good thing, even if it's got a reason. But why do we use the term sinat chinam, baseless hatred? That's the first thing. Second of all, who is the real villain in the story? What do you say?
The person who refused him entry.
Right, the host, right?
Embarrassing.
Right. And yet, the language of the Talmud is not like that. We need to understand that. Obviously, the villain was the host. He kicked him out. He embarrassed him in public. Right? And yet, the Talmud says that Jerusalem was conquered because of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. Now, first of all, Kamtza wasn't even there. Kamtza was the friend. He did nothing wrong. He was supposed to be invited. He wasn't even invited because he never got the invitation. And he didn't even show up. And Bar Kamtza came because he was invited and he got embarrassed. Hardly a villain. Right? So therefore, the story of the Talmud, the language is really strange. What do you mean that the Jerusalem was conquered because of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza? The Jerusalem was destroyed because of the host, not because of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. Right? So why does it use that language? And we need to know who it is. I mean, if you're gonna name and shame Kamtza and Bar Kamtza, why don't we at least know the name of the host, right? And as I said, Kamtza himself wasn't even there. He wasn't even involved. So what does it mean? So I want to take you back to the first story of Tisha B'Av. and have a look at something really important. So the first story of Tisha B'Av, again, as I said before, was the spies. The spies came back in the desert. They made the Jewish people cry, and they didn't want to go to the land of Israel, and God decreed that they should remain in the desert for 40 years, and only the next generation was going to go into the land of Israel. Now, if you look very closely, we've shared this many years ago, but I want to share this again because it's such an important idea. If you look at the verses in the Torah, you're going to see an interesting thing. Listen to this carefully. The spies came back and they gave a whole report. Part of their report was that the people in Israel, we saw giants there. They're strong, they're big, they're very hard to conquer, right? And they said the following verse, I'm going to read it in Hebrew and I'm going to translate it. They said, V'sham ra'inu et ha-nefilim b'nei anak min ha-nefilim. We saw the people called nefilim, which are giants and big people, strong people, huge people. And then they said the thing, they said the following. When we saw them in Israel, the 10 bad spies said, V'nehi b'einenu kachagavim. We were in our own eyes compared to them. We felt like grasshoppers. That's the word they use. Oh, we felt so small, like a grasshopper compared to a person. And they concluded, they said, V'chein hayinu b'einehem. And that's the way we were considered in their eyes. In other words, we felt like grasshoppers in their presence, and they looked at us as grasshoppers. Right? I want to ask you a question. The 10 spies, when they came back, they can certainly testify to how they felt. Whether it was legitimate, they felt the way. Whether it wasn't legitimate, they felt the way. That's not the issue. But they can say, "Vanehi be'einenu kachagavim." We felt in our own eyes, we felt like insects compared to these big giants. Fine. But how can they say that's the way they looked at us? How do you know how they looked at us? Right? And the simple answer is that if you feel small, someone else will see you as small as well. Right? They felt small, they felt inadequate, they felt insecure, they were lacking faith, they felt overwhelmed. They had a mission, they had a task, they had a promise from God that they would conquer the land of Israel, and they felt unable to do that. They felt a lack of confidence, they felt insecure. Right? If you feel insecure in the face of someone, that someone will treat you as insecurely as well. That's the way it goes. Right? So therefore the commentaries say that's why. We were in our own eyes, we were considered ourselves like grasshoppers, and therefore we're pretty confident that's the way they looked at us as well, which was probably true. And therefore that war would have indeed been a very, very hard war. Now, the term they use is chagavim, grasshoppers. Right? Now you know that I've shared this with you before, but there's if you look in any chumash, you'll see a translation on the side of the Chumash called Targum. Targum was an Aramaic translation, the very first translation written on the Torah, written by a great sage called Unkelis, who wrote, because that was the dialect at that time, it's still printed in every Chumash. And we are taught that Unkelis was such a great tzaddik, such a great sage, he wrote his translation on the Chumash with some degree of divine inspiration. It wasn't just a human translation, it was a translation that has very big significance because it was written with divine inspiration. If you have a look at the translation of the word chagavim, the translation of the word grasshoppers, right, at the Targum, in the Aramaic translation, you will see that he translates the words kamtsin, same word as kamtsa, right? Kamtsa also means a grasshopper, which links the story of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa to the story of the spies. Let's understand how this works. So again, the story of the spies is a story of lack of faith and therefore insecurity. Feeling low, inappropriately low. Not feeling legitimately humble, that's something different. But feeling illegitimately, inappropriately low. Why? What did it come from? Where did that low feeling of lowness come from? A feeling of lowness comes from a lack of connection with God. You see, humility, right? Humility comes, or strength comes, from being connected to God. If we feel that we were created by God, and we feel that we have a soul, and we feel that our soul has tremendous intrinsic value, then we feel that we have that intrinsic value. We feel we have inner strength. We feel we have that strength, which is connected to our faith, to our through our confidence to the Creator, to a bigger picture, to a bigger purpose, to a bigger being, and so on and so forth. And then there's no need to feel insecure, there's no need to feel threatened by other people or anything. So if they would have felt that way, and they had a promise from God that indeed the land of Israel would be given to them, then they would have had the confidence that we can conquer it. And in fact, we know that one of the explanations of their sin, right? Because it's a famous question. I'm not sure if we mentioned it here, but I did mention it recently somewhere. But there's a famous question on the story of the spies. Why were they in such trouble? The spies were sent to go and spy out the land. All they did was come and do their job. They came and reported back, right? But the answer that's given, of course, is that their mission was not to give an opinion if we can conquer the land. The mission was to say how we conquer the land. There's giants there, there's fortified cities, there's big armies, there's big walls. Okay, so let's strategize. In other words, the ability to conquer the land should have been a given. It was a promise from God. They should have had the faith and the confidence able to do it, and they didn't. And that was the sin of the Meraglim. The Meraglim came back and said, they didn't say we're reporting back, it's a strong place, a lot of walls, a lot of fortified cities, a lot of giants. They didn't say that. They said all of that, and therefore we don't think we can do this. That wasn't answered. That wasn't the mission. Right? And the Jews bought into this. They bought into the hysteria, they bought into the fear, the installation of fear, and they started to cry. Right? That's the story of the Chagavim, the story of the grasshoppers. They felt like grasshoppers. They felt like kamtzin in the time of the temple. That feeling of insecurity, that feeling of feeling low, is actually the source of arrogance and ego, right? As we know. And it's the source of baseless hatred. That's exactly what it is. Because we know that feeling low is not just a lack of faith, but lack of confidence. It's insecurity, and we know that the superiority complex, we've spoken about this many times, that superiority complex and inferiority complex is all the same complex. Right? It's about not understanding our true intrinsic value. It's about having the need to protect our fragile self. That's where arrogance comes from. Right? Arrogance comes from, sometimes you see a person and he looks so confident, and you know, and truth is, might not be that way at all. Sometimes people are overconfident because what happens is when someone feels insecure, when someone doesn't understand their true godly intent, intrinsic worth, but they feel low, they feel like they're not someone, they have to prove themselves. And therefore they feel like they are just a fragile human being. They need to protect that fragility. So normally what happens is one of two things happen. Either they show inappropriate humility, like they just become a doormat and let everyone step upon them, right? Or they become so arrogant that they make no room for other people because they have to constantly protect themselves. Right? And the source of ego is exactly the same source of the lack of confidence that the Jewish people had in the desert. Because when we understand, particularly from a Jewish point of view, when we understand that we are created by God, when we understand that we are created by an infinite God, and so are you, and so am I, and so is everyone else, and that our talents and our weaknesses, strengths and weaknesses and greatnesses and everything we have is actually from God. It's God-given. It doesn't make us superior to other people if we are talented, if we're not. It doesn't make us lower or higher than anyone else. And we know that we come from a being of infinity. In that being of infinity, there's plenty of room for everyone. Right? I've told the story many times, but there's a famous story of a Jew that went to a Hasidic rabbi called the Tzemach Tzedek, and he said to him, "Rabbi, when I'm in shul, everyone's trampling on me, figuratively speaking." So the Tzemach Tzedek said to him, "Who told you to spread yourself out in the whole shul? If you wouldn't spread yourself out everywhere, they wouldn't trample on you. In other words, make room for others. You don't have to take up the whole space." Right? Because when we have a fragile self, we have a lack of tolerance for other people. And we don't make room for other people. And we don't make room for God either. That's why the Talmud says that God says, "I can deal with anything. I can coexist with any type of person, no matter how low or high they might be, no matter how spiritual or non-spiritual or transgressive they might be. But with an arrogant person, I can't dwell together with I can't coexist with a person that's arrogant." This is part of the Talmud that talks about the evil of arrogance. Why not? If God can do everything, why can't he be? He says, because he doesn't let me in. If someone is arrogant, he doesn't let God in. That's why God can't coexist with him, right? And when a person is arrogant, that's when there's a lower tolerance for other people. And there's no room for other people. No room for other opinions. No room for other perspectives. Because we're always threatened. We're always feel threatened, right? That is the basis of what the Talmud calls sinat chinam, baseless hatred. If you ask anyone why they hate someone, they will tell you there's a reason. But in fact, we know that's not a reason. It's a post-reason most of the time. Because really, there's no room to hate anyone. Or to be completely lack of, you don't have to agree with them, you don't have to be their friend, you don't have to hang out with them, you don't have to, right? But there's really, unless it's complete evil, in cases of extreme evil, but normally there's no reason to hate someone. There's a reason to disagree or to protect yourself from someone, yes. But to hate someone means that you have an innate intolerance for the other person. You are threatened by the other person. Which is why the Talmud says that most hatred actually starts off chinam. It starts off in a baseless way. It starts off for no reason. It just starts off with a lack of, like Rabbi Tversky says, like having a sunburn and someone touches you on the sunburn and it's extreme pain. In other words, most people, because they have this low self-esteem or low perception of themselves, therefore need to prove themselves and feel superior to the other person. As soon as the person threatens them to the slightest, there's a complete rejection. The complete rejection leads to being annoyed at everything and being irritated by everything that they do. It leads to finding reasons why they're no good. It leads to finding rationale for the hatred that we have for them. And it leads to the unbelievable stupidity of throwing out someone because you're just threatened by them and embarrassing them and throwing them out, which is what the host of the party did, right? Humility, on the other hand, is different. And humility means there's plenty of room for other people. Not in a bad way, from a strength. Moses, says, was the greatest and most humble person of all time. Why? Moses knew how great he was, but yet he was the most humble because the commentaries tell us that Moses understood that all his talents, all his greatness was God-given. Yes, of course, he did a good job in nurturing it and revealing it and sustaining it and holding on to it and treasuring it. But he always felt that someone else could do that given the same opportunity. So therefore, Moses, with all his greatness, never felt superior to anyone. That's why he was the most humble of all people, right? Now let's go back to the story of the Gemara. So again, you see how the two stories are related. It's not just that the God said, you know, Tisha B'Av, you cry, therefore you're going to cry. You despise, you cry, now you're going to cry later. They're actually related. The reason that the story of the spies happened was from lack of true confidence, lack of inner strength. They felt themselves like chagavim, like grasshoppers, which is kamtze, same word. Therefore comes the Talmud and says, Jerusalem got destroyed because of kamtze and bar kamtze. What the Talmud means is, the Talmud is not even referring to the people necessarily. Yes, of course, the one person's name was Kamsa, the other one was Bar Kamsa. That was by divine providence, so it happened to be that way. But that's not what the Talmud actually means. In fact, the main villain of the story was the host, not even Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, as we said. And Kamsa wasn't even there. But what the Talmud is saying is, because of the concept of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, that's why Jerusalem was destroyed. That's what brought baseless hatred. That's what brought animosity. That's what brought lack of tolerance. Because of what the idea of kamtze and bar kamtze, what does that mean? Kamtze means this feeling of inferiority, this insecurity, which brings to arrogance. And bar kamtze means the son of kamtze, which means everything that comes from that feeling. All the derivatives, everything that's a consequence of that insecurity and arrogance, that's why Jerusalem was destroyed. In other words, everyone in the story suffered from kamtze, bar kamtze. We don't need to know the names of the host. The name of the host is not relevant. What we do need to know is what the host was suffering from. He was suffering from that syndrome of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, even though his name wasn't Kamsa. But everyone at the time was suffering. Because what I want to demonstrate to you in the last number of minutes is because this concept of having in many different levels, in many different ways, at the time of Tisha B'Av, and time of that story, everyone was suffering from the same problem. Let's have a look at it, right? So first of all, the host. Okay, so the host was suffering from it, right? The host was suffering from great insecurity, obviously, which is why he had the tremendous arrogance, which would lead to a complete intolerance to go and embarrass someone in public and refuse to let him stay to give him dignity, because as long as he was in the room, he was a contradiction to the essence of the host. That's a real Kamtze story. But it wasn't only the host, right? I mean, it's an unbelievable evil thing to do. But it's because he couldn't tolerate him being in the room. The guy came here. Okay, you don't have to invite him to your party, but he came. Don't embarrass him. No, but it was that level of insecurity was so great. That lack of tolerance, it was just unbelievable. Right? But it's not just him. unfortunately, even the good people sitting at the party, and this is where we get into the whole concept of bystanders, they didn't speak up. That's also a Kamsa and Bar Kamsa story. So again, the Talmud is not blaming it on those two people. One wasn't even there, and one was the victim. The Talmud is blaming on the concept of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Now, the sages sitting there weren't as arrogant as the host. They would never done such a thing themselves, but they didn't stand up when it was done, and that's a terrible thing. And we know that in modern times, the educational research is all about. I mean, I once had a whole discussion with a leading educator in the States. Her name is Rhoda Novick. She deals a lot with going into schools and dealing with bullying and stuff, right? And she was explaining to me that the biggest training we have to give to kids today is not even about the bully. It's about the bystander. Bystanders, because it's very hard. It's very hard not to be a bystander, right? There's a lot of stuff written on bystanding research and all this kind of stuff, right? Because it's very hard. It's very, especially for kids. Because the bully is normally the one who's the most outspoken, the one who like leads the cult, creates what's there to be cool. Everyone's scared of him or her. And therefore, you can have in a classroom where there's one bully against one victim, and all that needs to happen is for other kids to stand up and say it's not okay, and it doesn't happen. Not blaming them. It's a very hard thing to do. You need a lot of inner strength to be able to do that. Adults don't do that. The sages, even in that story, Kamsa didn't do that. And that's an incredible lesson. We not only not to engage in evil, but not to stand by when someone else is being hurt, when someone else is being embarrassed, someone else is being, you know, we talk about being silent. We often talk about nations being silent, leaders being silent, but we also have to learn the art of not being silent. We're all leaders. Sometimes we're in a situation where clear evil has been done and someone is clearly being wronged, and we don't stand up because we don't want to get involved. I'd rather not get involved. Sometimes that's not a luxury we can engage in. Sometimes we do have to get involved. One of the faults of that party in the Talmud was they should have spoken up and they didn't. But interestingly enough, it's actually not only the host, and it's not only the sages sitting there who didn't protest, but it's even the victim himself. Because even he did something wrong. He's also, sometimes you can be a victim and a villain at the same time. Because he also suffered from that. Why did he suffer from that? Now, he was wronged. Again, it's always very important, especially in today's culture. No one wants to be cancelled, right? But it is important intrinsically that when something is done to someone, the victim is not responsible for what was done. It's always the perpetrator, true. But at the same time, when we're nurturing this inner strength, and we're trying to understand that we have to build this inner strength that we have, everyone has to try and build that, the victim included. And therefore the victim has to also build an inner strength not to remain a victim. There's a Talmud which tells us, it doesn't always gel so perfectly with what modern society tells us sometimes, right? In other words, there's a very fine, nuanced line between someone saying, no, this is wrong, you cannot do this to me, and I'm going to stand up to it, and that should happen, and we should empower people to do that, and falling into victimhood. We talked a lot about this when we did Edith Eger's work, right? Because remaining a victim has also got to do with lacking inner strength. The Talmud talks about one of the greatest things is if a person gets screamed at and gets embarrassed, but yet finds the strength, not because of weakness, but has the ability to fire back and doesn't. Doesn't fire back in hate, doesn't fire back in anger. Does what they need to do, has the conversation they need to have, puts the boundaries to protect themselves, yes, but doesn't fire back in anger. Because you don't fight anger with anger, you don't fight hate with hate. And therefore, even in this story, everyone was suffering from the Kamsa and Bar Kamsa syndrome, including the victim. Because what was done to him was inexcusable. But going to the emperor and putting the entire Jewish nation in danger and himself in danger is also inexcusable. Because sometimes we have to also train ourselves and train our young ones that you've got to always protect yourself. You must never let yourself be abused or embarrassed or bullied, whatever the case is, but you also have to gain the strength to feel that inner strength inside. We all have to build that. We all have to build and understand our intrinsic value. And therefore not to fight back with the same evil that was done to you. The Talmud in fact says an incredible language. Let me just find the exact language here. I want to show it to you. The Talmud has a thing called ma'avir al midotav. Someone that from a strength says, you know, you criticized me, you said something I don't like, I'm okay. I'm not going to be angry back. I'm not going to continue what they call today the dance of anger, right? And the Talmud says that kol ma'avir al midotav, if someone does that, if he passes on his own, you know, he's not so into himself that everything is, as soon as someone looks at him the wrong way, it's a whole problem. If someone does that, God passes on all the things we do wrong. That's the reward. Ma'avirina kol pshaav. God forgoes the consequences of all our sins, all our transgressions. One of the greatest things we can do. Again, that doesn't mean that we have to be weak. Weakness is not a good thing. On the contrary, it needs to come from a strength, not a weakness. That we do what we need to do, but we don't exercise the same form of insecurity, the same form of anger, the same form of hate. And in fact, in that story, even at the end of the story, we find a little bit of insecurity on a different level. Where Rabbi Yochanan made a point, and he said, if you look at that story and you see that even when they came to the Sanhedrin, the leader of the Sanhedrin didn't have the strength. Rabbi Zachariah ben Afkulas, he also lacked a little bit of that courage and strength to sort the thing out so it doesn't go further. Either to bring the sacrifice or to kill or to execute Barakam, so whatever the case was, they didn't have the strength to sort it out. And therefore it was also a sign of weakness. Everyone, and that's what the Talmud is telling us, that Kamsa and Bar Kamsa was the source of the destruction of the temple. Insecurity which leads to baseless hatred, anger, hate, all of these things, revenge, all of these things come because we don't have that inner strength. We don't understand our real value. We don't make room for other people. And of course, the lesson for us is a very, very important lesson, because there's bad news and there's good news. The bad news is that unfortunately we haven't learned the lesson yet, right? Globally. I mean, it's very, very troubling when you look in the world, you look in the political world, where people are just out to get each other. It's okay to disagree, but not to disagree with hate, not to disagree where there's no room for other people, right? It's happening in Israel, it's happening in America, it's happening all over the world, right? And we all, within our own communities, with our own, you know, people don't talk to each other, people get angry with each other, people keep what they call broguses or faribles forever and ever and ever. That after about 20 years, you ask the person, why don't you talk to the other person? They're not even sure why. They just know they don't talk to them. Right? I don't talk to that person, right? Someone will tell you, I haven't spoken to this person for 25 years. We really need to work on that, because we are told, the commentaries tell us, and this is the comforting part, in a way, because we have to understand what that means. The sages tell us that the temple was destroyed because of stories like Kamsa Bar Kamsa. It was destroyed because of baseless hatred. And therefore we are taught that we're going to return to Jerusalem. We're going to have the temple again. We're going to be merit to the coming of Mashiach through what? Through baseless love. Baseless love means making room for other person just because they're another person. You don't love them. Sometimes we love people because there's a reason to love them. We like them. We have common interests. We have common values. We're compatible. We get on with them. We have good time together. That's all reasons. No, we have to be tolerant of people for no reason. Just because they're a human being, they're because you're created by God, as we were, and there's plenty of room for both of us. If we disagree, that's fine. If we don't like each other, that's fine. You don't have to invite them to your parties. But we have to treat them like a human being. We still say hello to another person. We still wish them happy birthday, Shana Tova, whatever the case is, right? So the question is, in a way, that's a very strong, powerful thing. I'm going to end with this before we draw the raffle. It's a very beautiful idea, but it's also a very painful idea. Because it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. It looks like the way the world's going, it's actually getting worse, not better, right? So what do you mean when we get told that it's all going to come to an end, it's all going to get better when we exercise the opposite of what happened with the destruction of the temple, and we exercise baseless love rather than baseless hatred? So it doesn't look like the whole world's going to get there soon. So the Chofetz Chaim, the great Chofetz Chaim, said, based on a Zohar, Chofetz Chaim was a great sage. I mentioned him before. He lived before the war. He wrote all books on not talking Lashon Hara and gossip. He was very strong on that topic, right? Topic of positive speech, good relationships, and so on. He was very... And he said the following. He said, based on a Zohar. The Zohar is the seminal book of Kabbalah, and he said it's written on the Zohar, based on the Zohar. And he said that for God to bring the future redemption, he's not waiting for the whole world to do this. So he says, and if one kehillah, if one group of people will start to really exercise baseless love, that will be enough to tip the scales. So we don't have to change the world. We just have to change ourselves. Right? If any group of people get together and they make up, no, we're going to just tolerate each other, respect each other, include people that we don't like necessarily. We're going to treat them with dignity. We never know the power of what that can do. That's a very, very powerful thing. So we don't have to look at the world and say, oh, sometimes it's a very painful thing and sometimes a saddening thing. We look at the world and we say, oh, the world's just a mess. No, we need to understand the power of a few people. If we just did this ourselves, we just looked at our own life, our own relationships, our own people that we know, we just improved the way we relate to other people. We improved our tolerance, we improved our dignity and our respect to other human beings. That in itself is a very, very powerful thing. So we'll leave it there. So we're gonna draw the raffle as we always do at this point. Leivikol? Yep.